We are literally just hours from the crucifixion as we open our Bibles today to Matthew 27. 3 weeks ago, we examined the religious trial of Jesus before Annas and Caiaphas. 2 weeks ago, we considered the betrayal of Judas and his tragic suicide. Last week, of course, Tom Nelson was here and brought a wonderful message about work. But this morning, I want to focus our attention on Pilate. His remarkable witness about the character of Jesus is especially valuable. You might expect Jesus' friends to proclaim him absolutely innocent. But here we have Pilate, who was never a follower of Jesus. But this man, though he ordered his execution, declared Jesus absolutely innocent. That is a powerful testimony indeed. The first thing we must understand as we look at this man Pilate is that his political problems are critical to the role he plays in Jesus' crucifixion. Pilate is a well-known person in the pages of secular history, as well, of course, as in the pages of Scripture. The Jewish historian Josephus writes quite a bit about Pilate, and so does Philo of Alexandria. In 1961, Pilate's name was found on a tablet excavated by archaeologists in Caesarea. It read Tiberium Pontius Pilatus, prefect of Judea. What we learn about him is that Pilate was a Roman citizen, born in Italy in approximately 1 BC, so he is almost the same age as Jesus himself. He is in his early 30s when Matthew 27 takes place. We know he was married. He was a member of the equestrian class in Rome, and he was quite wealthy. His early career is unknown, but he must have held quite a few positions of civil and military significance before being appointed to such an important position as the governor of a province. The picture we get of him is definitely of an ambitious young politician seeking to climb the ladder of political power and influence. Pilate was first appointed governor of Judea in AD 26 by the emperor Tiberius. He was only 27 years old. His area of jurisdiction was Samaria, Judea, Gaza, and as far south as the Dead Sea. He did not have control over Galilee, which will become an important point a little later in the story. His functions included military and administrative duties. But the Jews were granted a fair amount of self-government and liberty. The Jewish religious leaders, for example, could judge their own people, except that they did not have the right of capital punishment. That remained with the Roman governor. Because of political and religious unrest being very common in Judea, the Romans considered it one of their most difficult provinces to govern. On two occasions prior to the trial of Jesus, Pilate had run into major problems with the Jewish people. One occurred on his very first visit to Rome. He was accompanied by a large detachment of Roman soldiers, each of whom carried a banner or a standard. And on the top of the pole, they had a little bust of the Roman Caesar. The Jews objected that that was an idol, a god, and they demanded that Pilate remove those busts from the standards. He refused to do so. They followed him all the way back to Caesarea and for 5 days dogged his steps. He finally told them to meet him in the gathering place there on the shore, Caesarea. And He told them that if they didn't stop their demands, he would behead them all. The Jews bared their necks and dared him to do it. Pilate realized he was beaten. This is how his tenure in Israel began. Not a very auspicious beginning. The second confrontation occurred not long after that one. The Jerusalem water supply was inadequate, and Pilate decided to build a new aqueduct. He didn't have the money for it, so he raided the temple treasury. He had good reason to do that, because much of the water was needed to wash away the blood from 200,000 sacrifices every year. But the Jews thought that taking the temple money for that was sacrilegious, and they rioted. Pilate mingled his soldiers with the people, and at a given signal, they clubbed to death hundreds of Jews. This incident actually served as a sermon illustration for Jesus in Luke chapter 13. It says, "Now there were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans, whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. Jesus answered, 'Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will perish.'" But the confrontations I have just mentioned between Pilate and the Jews were nothing compared to the most troubling predicament he ever faced, and that was the trial of Jesus of Nazareth. Though Pilate's home and palace are in Caesarea, he happens to be in Jerusalem at this time because it is Passover, and the Jews often get in a kind of a riotous nature during Passover, and so as governor, he is in Jerusalem. He is awakened in the very early hours before dawn on the day before Passover by a mob which demands that he deal with a certain prisoner of theirs. The urgency is that they want to get his execution over before Passover starts at 6 p.m. in the evening, because they don't want to defile themselves. The sheer hypocrisy of such scruples is certainly striking. He is awakened in the, I already mentioned that. By the time Jesus is brought to Pilate's judgment hall, he has already been subjected to one religious trial of sorts. He had been arrested about midnight in the Garden of Gethsemane and was taken to the home of Annas, who is the high priest emeritus, and from there to the home of Caiaphas, who is the ruling high priest. Peter's denial and Judas's betrayal follow. And we begin to pick up the reading in Matthew 27, verses 1 and 2, and then verse 11. Matthew 27, 1. "Early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death. They bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor." Verse 11. "Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, 'Are you king of the Jews?' 'Yes, it is as you say,' Jesus replied. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, 'Don't you hear the testimony they are bringing against you?' But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Now it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, 'Which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?' For he knew it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message: 'Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him.' But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. 'Which of the two do you want me to release to you?' asked the governor. 'Barabbas,' they answered. What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called Christ? Pilate asked. They all answered, crucify him. Why? What crime has he committed? Asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, crucify him. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. I am innocent of this man's blood, he said. It is your responsibility. All the people answered, let his blood be on us and on our children. Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed over to them to be crucified. This is the word of the Lord. In the very early morning, perhaps as early as 3 a.m., when the religious leaders decided that Jesus should die, they still needed a civil trial in order to execute him legally. Thus, they bring him to the Praetorium, which is the Roman governor's mansion in Jerusalem. Once again, Jewish scruples surface as they refuse to enter the Gentile's palace because they don't want to be defiled. And so Pilate comes out to them and he asks, what are the charges against Jesus? If you read all four Gospels, you find that they bring four major charges against him. First, subverting the nation. Second, opposing the payment of taxes to Caesar. Third, claiming to be Christ, a king. And fourth, stirring up the people. Of course, only one of those charges is true, one that he claimed to be Christ, a king. But even that one, they misconstrued. The Jews portrayed him as a political messiah, a threat to Rome, which of course he was not. In response to these charges, Pilate questions Jesus and receives a mixed response. When he asks Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus acknowledges it. But when Pilate asks him, don't you hear the testimony that they are bringing against you? Jesus refuses to respond. And Pilate is amazed at his silence. I assume that Pilate believes he could easily have answered these charges against him, but he chooses not to. It is here that the Gospel of John records a good deal more conversation between Pilate and Jesus than we read about in Matthew. John includes the well-known soliloquy by Jesus in which he says, in effect, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my followers would fight. John also records the profound question that Pilate asked Jesus. What is truth? Most importantly, John tells us that Pilate informs the Jewish religious leaders, I find no basis for a charge against him. Not only is Pilate saying that there's no capital offense here, he doesn't even see any evidence in fact for the charges that they have brought against Jesus. This is the first of at least four declarations of innocence by Pilate in regard to Jesus' character. You can read the others in Luke 23, verses 14, 15, and 22. Even Pilate's wife asserts Jesus' innocence, as we read a few moments ago. Pilate was sitting on the judgment seat when his wife sends a message. This had to be important for her to interrupt a trial that was in process. But she tells Pilate about this dream she has had. She says, have nothing to do with that innocent man. This only highlights the fact that Pilate has no excuse whatever for agreeing to Jesus' execution. This is not a case where the evidence is ambiguous. The evidence is absolutely clear, and it points only to Jesus' innocence. To his slight credit, we might add that Pilate tries every conceivable way to extricate himself from responsibility for Jesus' death. First, He tells the Jewish religious leaders to handle Jesus' case themselves. This isn't obvious in Matthew's account, but it is in the Gospel of John, chapter 18, verse 31. It says, Pilate said, take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. Of course, they won't do that because they don't have the right to execute anyone and they want Jesus dead. Pilate realizes that he's dealing with an irrational mob. And suddenly he sees a glimmer of hope. One of Jesus' accusers happens to mention that Jesus is from Galilee. And that causes Pilate to ask, is he a Galilean? And that is of great interest to Pilate because he's not in charge of Galilee. He can change the venue here and send Jesus to Herod for him to judge and get rid of the responsibility. As luck would have it, Herod is in Jerusalem for Passover. And so we see, secondly, that he turns Jesus over to Herod's jurisdiction. As it turns out, Herod is thrilled to see Jesus. He's heard about him, and he would love to see a miracle. But Jesus refuses to do a miracle for Herod. He always refused to perform miracles just to titillate the skeptics. Herod and his soldiers mock Jesus and ridicule him. But Pilate's hope that Herod would deal with the situation goes unrealized when Herod sends him back to Pilate. Luke adds an aside. He says, that day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. It's another case of the old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Pilate makes a third attempt to escape responsibility for Jesus' execution. He suggests a compromise to the Jews. He will punish Jesus. One cannot help but think, why punish a man if he's innocent? But Pilate is caught between a rock and a hard place. Flogging Jesus is better than executing him. But this too, the Jews reject. They will accept nothing but his death. Pilate's fourth attempt has to do with a particular tradition among the Jews. He offers to release Jesus as the Passover criminal. The Jews had a custom of releasing a prisoner on the Passover holiday as a gesture of kindness and mercy and celebration. Pilate latches onto this custom as an opportunity to escape the dilemma he is in. He can release Jesus, which he plainly wants to do, but at the same time, he will technically be convicting him because only a convicted criminal could be released. So the Jews should be appeased. Jesus is convicted, and yet he gets to let him go. So he offers them a choice. He will release Jesus or another criminal. And he chooses the public enemy number one, a notorious criminal named Barabbas. Surely these Jews, no matter how much they hate Jesus, will not want an insurrectionist and a murderer released to walk their streets. But he has underestimated the hatred the religious leaders have for Jesus or the influence they have with the mob. They choose to have Barabbas released and Jesus crucified. Just think about that a moment. Do you realize this is tantamount to releasing someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed into our society? If given a choice between him and, say, Scooter Libby, it's even a greater contrast than that. Because Scooter Libby was guilty of something. Jesus was guilty of nothing. And yet they accept public enemy number one to be released. His fifth attempt is found in verse 22 of our chapter. Again, he tries to compromise, ordering Jesus to be flogged. And, excuse me, this is Luke chapter 23, verse 22. And crowned with thorns to stir up sympathy. The actual deed is described more fully in John chapter 19, but we won't look at it this morning. We'll examine that more closely next week. But Pilate parades the suffering Jesus before the crowd, and he says, "Here is the man." He uses an expression there in Greek, which means, "Look at the poor creature." I'm convinced that Pilate's purpose is to show them how ridiculous it is to think that this poor man with his crown of thorns on his head, who can't even carry his own cross, he's so weak, would be any threat to them. But Pilate's attempt produces the opposite effect. For when the chief priests and the religious leaders see Jesus, they cry out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Sixth attempt to release Jesus is also found in John chapter 19, where after a troubling conversation with Jesus, he tries again to release him, but the Jews intimidate Pilate by mentioning Caesar. The last words between Pilate and Jesus are probably the most profound. Pilate asked Jesus, John 19, 8-12, "Where do you come from?" But Jesus refuses to answer. Pilate pleads with him, "Do you refuse to speak to me? Do you not realize that I have the power to either free you or crucify you?" And then Jesus answers with those profound words, "You would have no power at all over me if it were not given to you from above." Friends, those are words that every king and prime minister and president, every dictator should take to heart. All authority has been given to Christ. He can retract it or use it whenever he chooses. These are also words that every persecutor of Christians should take to heart, whether communist or fascist or atheist or humanist. They are words that every unbeliever should take to heart. God is still in control, and let his detractors never forget it, no matter how great their temporary authority or influence. And these are words that every believer should remember. No matter how great the opposition that we face at particular times, or how severe our trials, all authority has been given to Christ. And we belong to him. That means that we are on the winning side. Now, following this conversation, Pilate renews his efforts to free Jesus. But the Jews finally pull out their trump card. "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." Now the wheels start turning in Pilate's head. He remembers the previous confrontations he's had with these Jews. He remembers the little images on the standards and how they beat him in that confrontation. And he remembers the time when he slaughtered a number of the Jews. And Caesar had heard about these times, and Caesar was not pleased. If he has another confrontation, he's going to be in big trouble. And so John tells us when Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement. This is where sentences were handed down. Pilate has wrestled with this issue for many hours now. He has sought every means he could to avoid condemning an innocent man. But every step he has taken has been frustrated. Even now, he makes one last effort to extricate himself from responsibility. Once more, he tries to use shame and sympathy. With Jesus standing before him at the judgment seat, Pilate asks the Jews, says to them, "Here is your king." But they cry out, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." And Pilate asks, "Shall I crucify your king?" And then the chief priests, the religious leaders of Israel, answer with one of the most stunning statements you can possibly imagine. "We have no king but Caesar." These are the Jewish people to whom the Ten Commandments were given, the first of which says, "You shall have no other gods before me." These are the same people who rioted a few years earlier because of little metal images on the top of Roman standards. And now they are crying out, "We have no king but Caesar." So far, perhaps our sympathies lie a bit with Pilate because he intended to let Jesus go. But you know the old statement, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Pilate's intentions may have been honorable, but his ultimate actions were despicable. For he condemns an innocent man while futilely declaring his own innocence. Listen again to Matthew 27, 24 to 26. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It is your responsibility." All the people answered, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed over to be crucified. The washing of the hands was a religious ritual of great significance among the Jewish people. Pilate borrowed it for his own purposes here, to salve his own conscience. But friends, nothing is more useless and worthless than a religious rite that has no reality behind it. People are constantly trying to alleviate their consciences with religious rites. Baptism, church membership, tithe, good works, countless other things. But all of them together don't count for anything if their hearts are not right with God. One of the common tourist sites in Rome is the Scala Santa, or the sacred stairs of the judgment seat of Pilate. It is thought that these were the very stairs in Jerusalem that were moved to Rome for purposes that people could see them more readily and walk up them on their knees. There's no historical evidence that these are actually the stairs, but many have believed it. And many walk up those stairs on their knees to try to gain favor with God. Martin Luther did that on those very stairs. But while he was walking those stairs almost 500 years ago, he remembered the words of the book of Romans, which afterward became the watchwords of the Reformation. "The just shall live by faith, not by religious ritual." He came to the important realization that ritual without faith is nothing. Well, Pilate declares himself innocent, but it doesn't make it so. The fact remains that he is seated to the execution of an innocent man. Perhaps his guilt is not as great as those of the Jewish religious leaders clamoring for his death. In fact, Jesus himself said they are guilty of greater sin John 19:11. But if they are guilty of greater sin, that still means Pilate was guilty of sin. It may be that someone here this morning has judged Jesus innocent, as Pilate did. Perhaps you think he was a good man, a great teacher, an amazing example. But if that's all you've done, is to judge him innocent, if you have not bowed the knee to him in faith, then you also have agreed to his death. I want to share an epilogue about Pilate. He desperately wanted to keep his job as governor of Rome, and that is why he agreed to the demands of the Jewish people. But secular history tells us that at the age of 36, he was recalled to Rome, deposed as governor, banished to Gaul, and committed suicide there. Tradition tells us that he bargained for temporary security instead of eternal security, and he lost both. Pilate would never know it, but his name would eventually become the most familiar in all of Roman history. For uncounted millions in future ages who knew little or nothing about Julius Caesar or Augustus or Tiberius or even Nero would know the name of Pilate because they would regularly confess, "I believe in Jesus Christ who suffered under Pontius Pilate." What a pitiful epitaph for a pitiful person. In conclusion, I want to talk very briefly about another basin that is well known in the Passion story. We read about it in John 13, in the story of the Last Supper. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. Jesus had nothing to prove. He was secure in his Father's love and secure in his destiny. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Then after the supper, Jesus said to the disciples, "Do you understand what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, because that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set an example for you that you should do as I have done for you." Which basin are you going to take up today? Would be the basin of Pilate in order to wash your hands of responsibility for the death of Christ? To declare him innocent, a good teacher, a great teacher, but you're not responsible. You've washed your hands. Or are we willing to acknowledge that our sin put him on the cross, to receive him as personal Savior, and to be obedient disciples in taking up the basin of humble love to wash one another's feet? Let's bow it.